Reentry. 74 days, 16 to go. First morning waking up in the apartment on 15th Street. I stay up until midnight the night before and from my bed watch the lights of the Empire State Building click off. I can almost hear the old skyscraper sigh as it goes dark, as if exhausted from the long day. I haven't unpacked or set the place up yet, but I've moved my things in from 1/5. Noah and I agree I should move out without him around, so 3 days before, I move out of Dave's, and with permission from Jack to cross into the trigger zone, I go. I ask my friend Sai if she'll come with me, and she agrees. I ask her for several reasons. One, she's been up to White Plains a few times and has been supportive. Two, she's worked as a counselor for people diagnosed with HIV, AIDS, and other fatal illnesses since the 80s, and very little makes her blink. Three, she's drop-dead gorgeous, unusually chic, and well, the woman can enter a building. It comforts me somewhat that she will be at my side, like a glamorous force field, as I re-enter for the first time the building I left on a stretcher. She meets me in front of 1/5, looking like she always does, thank God, hooks her arm in mine, and says, "Okay, kid, let's get this over with." I practically hide behind her as we enter. Even though Noah arranges for keys to be left at the front desk, and even with Sai at my side, I'm afraid they won't let me in. It's been 2 months since I collapsed through these same doors, unable to stand up, begging for a key. 2 months since the ambulance drove me away to Lenox Hill. Jose, one of the doormen, is at the desk, and the moment he sees me says, with exaggerated kindness and what I can't help but suspect is sarcasm, "Noah has left you keys." How many times did Jose buzz up one of my dealers or watch me come in the door with shady characters I'd picked up in Washington Square Park when Noah was away? He can be sarcastic all he wants, I think, and suddenly wonder how many other people in the building carried on the way I had. Anyone? Many? In rehab and in the meetings, I've heard dozens of stories like mine. On the surface, successful people carrying on what look like respectable lives in buildings like this one, who at night turn into drug-addled zombies, buzzing up drug dealing and using vampires from their lobbies. Maybe I wasn't the only one at 1/5 living such a messy life. Maybe I wasn't anything out of the ordinary. As much as I want to believe this, the wary and pitying look in Jose's eyes suggest otherwise. Sai and I get in the elevator and get off on the 6th floor. The hallway is just as it was, just a hallway. Indifferent, a little stuffy with its green and gold striped walls and beige corporate carpeting. The new locks in the door are still shiny, and as we enter the apartment, Benny is right away at our feet, meowing and purring, and then, unlike her, immediately slinking away out of sight. She disappears into the den and only later creeps to the edge of the bedroom while I'm packing my clothes into duffel bags. "Join the club," I say to her as she eyes me doubtfully from across the room and keeps her distance. It will take 2.5 days to get all my stuff, including the cat, out of Noah's and over to 15th Street. Sai doesn't come back the next days, but it's okay. I race through the place, taking clothes from drawers, jackets and shoes from closets, and pulling books off the shelves Noah and I had built when we first moved in, the ones we found the design for in a book called Living with Books. We bought a pile of similar books and over dinner one night at L'Acajou, pored over the glossy pages until we found a simple design that fit the place. Did I get drunk that night, I wonder painfully? Pulling my books from the shelves and shoving them into cardboard boxes, I cringe with regret and wish that I could go back in time and do it all differently. But even if I could, would I be able to keep from drinking, keep from sneaking into the bathroom and calling a dealer? Even within spitting distance of 90 days, I'm not so sure. I snoop for signs of a new love. I'm queasy with jealousy, even though I ended our relationship at the strong recommendation of my counselor in rehab. My sister and several close friends who all urged me to get sober on my own, away from what each described in one way or another as a codependent dynamic of addict and enabler that Noah and I had, it seems, perfected. My desperation and need of their support were and are so great that I didn't question them and agreed. Noah is angry with me at first, but a counselor from the rehab calls and explains and asks him to give me the space I need to get healthy. I have not seen him for over 2 months. And our only contact has been crisp and spare and specific to the details of my moving out. Rarely does an hour go by when I don't question the decision to break up, doubt that it's the right choice. But something more than the advice of others keeps me from changing my mind, something beyond logic or want that keeps me from calling Noah and running back into his arms. In between packing boxes and duffel bags, I checked the caller ID box for unfamiliar and frequently appearing phone numbers, too many to form any conclusions. Sift through the bedside table drawers for evidence of sex, lubricant, condoms, and find nothing. Frisk Noah's gray helmet-length blazer and the pockets of his gray snap-front jacket, and again, nothing. Just lighters and cigarettes, which is clear he's now taken up again, openly. I'd been a tyrant about smoking when we were together, which now seems just as ironic and hypocritical as it was. On the last day, once everything is packed and ready to go, I sit in the corner window of the living room and finger the beige and brown animal print fabric on the window seat. There is a small, square pillow made with the same fabric leaning against the window, and I wonder if I should take it with me. The fabric came from a store in Islington, in London, where we spent 4 or 5 weekends in an apartment I split the rent on in my 20s. Buying that fabric, having that window seat cushion and pillow made, seemed, at 27, like the most adult, most worldly thing one could do. I laugh out loud at my younger, now faraway self, and am amused for a brief flash before the tight fist of grief returns. I watch the early evening lights blink on up lower Fifth Avenue, and the white headlights rush toward me. How many times had I sat here? And in what states? Furious, ashamed, worried, high, hopeful, hating, drunk, arrogant, panicked, exhausted, in love. I sit for a few more minutes and remember as much as I can before I go. I leave the pillow behind. Several nights later, Dave organizes tickets to go to the opera. I think but am not sure we see Aida that night. I remember it was long and one of the old Zeffirelli productions at the Met. We eat dinner in the overpriced, still glamorous restaurant on the grand tier level of the building. Starters and main course during the first intermission and dessert and coffee during the second. Dave's seats at the opera are good ones. Center grand tier, which is the second balcony, second row, in the middle. And the people seated around us all look like longtime opera goers, dressed nicely, not extravagantly like the tourists in the orchestra section. I can't help but think everyone here has been sitting in these seats since they were teenagers, have seen these operas hundreds of times, and are quite alert to the polluting presence of anyone who has not. Having spent the day at the 12:30 and 2 o'clock library meetings, and the afternoon sitting in Union Square with Asa, telling him about some of the grittier details of the double life I lived as an addict, I find that this refined eveningscape does not feel comfortable. Over dinner, Dave keeps talk within the firm boundaries of opera, his family, and popular culture. Only once does he ask how things are going, and I'm careful not to sound too positive or too discouraged. I don't actually say one day at a time, but I might as well. I am like a careful apprentice with a benevolent but stern mentor, aware at every second that I am lucky to be given any time at all in light of his many kindnesses, the pickup and drop off at rehab, the use of the writing studio on Charles Street, all the phone calls and emails he's had to field from concerned and angry people who became aware that he was in contact with me after I disappeared months ago. I tread carefully and wonder if we'll ever be at ease with each other again. Once the opera is over, we take a cab downtown. I'm grateful he directs the driver to my address first and then his own, as I know my days of paying for cab rides are over. We say our goodbyes, and I head into my building for what will be my second night there. I get into the elevator, which, despite the fact that the apartment is relatively cheap and the building is all rentals, has an elevator man. The one on duty now is not one I've seen before, so I tell him to go to 17. He says, "Okay, boss," in an accent that I think must be either Croatian or Georgian. I get to my apartment and notice two large paper shopping bags hanging from the doorknob. When I see the quiche boxes from Eli's Bakery jutting out from one of the bags, I know they're from Jean. There is a card taped to a handle, and on it my name is scrawled in Jean's inimitably looping and jagged cursive. Inside it reads, "Welcome to your new home and your new life. With so much love, Jean." I open the door and unpack the bags, which are filled with quiches and salads and roasted meats. Some of the food is from Eli's Bakery, some from Zabar's, and some made by Jean's chef, Paul. There are even delicate Austrian chocolates from the Neue Gallery. After I put the food away, I stand in front of the now full refrigerator and shout, "Thank you, Jean!" I realize, with relief and a little gust of confidence, that I don't have to buy food for at least a week. I go out to the terrace. It's a crisp spring night, and the lights of the city are dancing. It's after midnight, so I can make out only the ghosty outline of the now dark Empire State Building. I'm relieved to be away from Dave, away from what I imagine to be his nervous scrutiny. I think about his writing studio on Charles Street, the creaky steps, the downstairs neighbor poised to pounce at the slightest hint of nefarious activity. I think of the entire precarious time there and remember how during the first afternoon, within minutes of Dave's leaving, I'd been consumed with the desire to get high. How lucky I didn't, I think. What a miracle the craving passed. The city blinks its light, police sirens sound, faint music from another apartment comes and goes with the breeze. And then, just as it had that afternoon, the old craving returns. How do I describe it? It's like skin that feels perfectly fine one moment and then is ablaze with an itch the next. It looks the same. Skin, harmless, unfettered skin. But all at once it's screaming to be ravaged with fingernails and rubbed raw. I look back into the apartment through the small, square window in the door and think, there is nothing and no one to stop me. I can get high in this apartment, which is mine alone, and no one is coming home or arriving in the morning. I then look down at the scattered traffic on 7th Avenue and think, if all else fails, there are 17 floors and a hard sidewalk. I know I should call Jack, or Asa, or one of the dozen numbers that are now in my phone from people at the library and other meetings. Call someone, I say out loud, but even as I say the words, I know it's too late. My mind whizzes with ways to get drugs. Since Jack made me get a new cell phone, I don't have Happy or Rico's numbers, and I can't remember them. Then it occurs to me, Mark's place on Houston and 6th. He's always using and always up. It's midweek and before 1 a.m. If he doesn't already have drugs in the apartment, he can easily get some. Better to go there than to call Happy or Rico anyway, since I owe them each $1,000. I go. Out the door, down the elevator, and onto 7th Avenue, where I quickly duck into a bodega and head to the cash machine. I have less than $200 in my checking account, but I also have 3 credit cards with separate limits for cash advances. I dimly remember being asked to set a PIN code for at least one. I am practically dancing as I scour my wallet for credit cards. I try one and use the PIN for my regular cash card, and it doesn't work. I try another and get the same result. I try the third, and again, no luck. So I go back to the first and play around with a few combinations of the PIN code for my cash card. I replace the last 2 numbers with zeros, and bingo, it works. I advance $400 and am electric with anticipation of getting high. It's been so long. I rush out onto 7th Avenue and a cab immediately pulls up. I step in and realize that at some point, either on the terrace or just after, I have left the world I had been living in and entered another, or rather re-entered the one that had been waiting. I tell the cab driver the address and think I hear him say, didn't take long. Right away I ask him what he just said and he responds calmly in a Jamaican accent, nothing my friend, nothing. We're at Mark's in a few minutes and to my surprise the meter registers a fare, which he is clearly waiting for. I pay and he mumbles something which I hear as be God, but figures he means be good. I'm at the door, the same door I've stood at dozens and dozens of times, looking at the same buzzer and hoping the same hope. That Mark is home and that Mark has drugs. Whatever hesitation struggled against desire on the terrace less than an hour before is now gone. I am giddy and antsy and shuffling before the door as if something wonderful is waiting on the other side. Nothing of the past months, nothing of the ruin and upset my using has caused figures into this moment. Or if it does, it's a dim unpleasantness that along with every other worry is being escaped. The world and its woe exists on this side of the door, where I am now. The place to hide from it all is on the other, where I'm going. I press the button and in seconds hear Mark's voice, metallic and loud through the intercom. Who is it? He squawks, and before I say my name, the door is buzzing open.